The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell, joined by Sam Robson for part one of our J1 Quickstravaganza that will also feature my chat with Scott McIntyre. Sam, we have a literal boatload of questions to get through, so no niggling injuries to report. Are you fit and firing?
I am absolutely fit and firing. I just want to say thank you to everyone for all the great array of questions we've got coming up. And it means I don't have to spend too much, if any, time speaking about the Levain Cup.
Well, terrific stuff. I'm all in favour of that. And yes, echo your thoughts on the great questions from the Twitter sphere and also some of our supporters on Patreon. Also along for the ride is Dan Orlowitz from the Japan Times. Dan, welcome back for your first J-Talk appearance of 2020. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. Congratulations on starting another season, and congratulations to Sam for joining the cast.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, very nice of you to say, Dan. Outstanding stuff. So, yes, I put the feelers out for questions on Twitter last week. And, yes, as Sam has said, we were extremely pleased with the response. So, after we briefly review the first round of the Asian Champions League group stage played last midweek, we'll attack our first bunch of questions before throwing to my chat with Scott, which is just over 45 minutes long and, to be honest, could have been a standalone podcast. After that, we'll return with a few more questions to round out part one before answering all of the other questions in part two. So if your question didn't make the part one cut, please don't be put out. They will all be addressed over the course of the two episodes. So, guys, yeah, before we dive into the questions, let's kick things off with a look back at the first round of the ACL group stage. And it was almost a perfect start for the J1 clubs last midweek, Sam. If only Adailton had not put through his own net inside the last 10 minutes, FC Tokyo might have hung on to win away at Ulsan. But, yeah, apart from that, it was all systems go for Yokohama against Junbuk and especially Kobe in their ACL debut.
Yeah, it was three really good performances. I think even though the scoreline is best for Kobe, I thought Yokohama's result against Junbuk was incredible. They played Junbuk off the park, and not many teams do that away from home. It's probably the toughest assignment you can get in the Champions League. And 2-1 flattered Junbuk. I mean, Yokohama dominated from start to finish, should really have got three or four more goals. I think that could be an issue going forward. Adewunayo missed about three really clear-cut chances, and they almost got punished for that, but otherwise fairly flawless from them. Kobe, Ogawa gets the hat-trick, a very well-taken hat-trick, but Iniesta absolutely ran the show. He was fantastic. And then even Tokyo, a lot better, a lot more upbeat in their attacking tempo. I thought the Brazilian trio worked really well. And 1-1 is a fantastic result in Ulsan, and you will be disappointed at being 1-0 up with about 10 minutes to play, but a lot of positives for all three sides, in my opinion.
Indeed, indeed. And Dan, I'm sure you're up to speed with all the AFC and all their coefficients and stuff. How did it transpire that the champions of South Korea and the champions of Japan are in the same group? Surely there would be some sort of a better seeding done that would mean that would not take place. I mean, we did get to see two cracking teams face each other, and I guess I shouldn't begrudge that fact. But, yeah, I thought I was surprised to see that those two drawn against each other to begin with. But then, yeah, Yokohama to turn on the style in the way they did was especially pleasing.
I need to go back and look at that, but I'm pretty sure, if memory serves, that that sort of group happens every season or something like it, where there's usually one specific group in the East Zone with two or three league champions. And I'm not quite sure how that works out. It's tough because the way that everything is divided with the playoffs to avoid any chance of the playoff teams and the direct seeds having being from the same country, I guess there's just some weird way of arranging it that gets the champions in the group. I don't mind it. I think it's cool to have one solid group of death in each zone. I imagine that will change next year once the new coefficients come into play.
Yeah, I guess so. And, of course, yeah, people from the supporters of the A-League are screaming into their iPods at the moment. Well, yeah, what about Sydney, the champions of Australia? And, well, yeah, they're going to be Yokohama's next opponent this coming Wednesday in ACL match day two. Tokyo kicked things off again when they host Perth, also of the A-League. That's at Tokyo Stadium on the Tuesday night. Then, yes, Yokohama hosts Sydney at the Nissan. And Kobe are away. It's their turn to visit South Korea as they face Suwon Blue Wings. So that should be another interesting test. I guess, Sam, before we leave the ACL, I mean, yeah, Kobe's scoreline obviously was the banner news from ACL Match Day 1 from a J1 perspective. You'd expect them to get a much sterner test away against Suwon, so hopefully nobody from Vissel is getting complacent on the road to becoming the best team in Asia after just one match day, because it's definitely going to get harder than against the JTD last week.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the easiest game they're going to face in the Champions League, and they came through it very well with good professional performance. We're never under any real pressure and just kind of dominate the game, but Suwon have given plenty of teams a lot of tough games in recent memory. I remember a tie with Kashima, I believe it was, I think on the way to get into the final and winning it a couple of years ago. It was an end-to-end game, lots of attacking talent on show from Suwon. They've kind of dropped off a little bit in Korea for the last couple of seasons, but it's always difficult when Japanese teams travel to Korea, and yeah, that should be a really exciting game. But they all are in the ACL. I know you get these weird groups where there are three champions in there and whatnot, but they're so well matched in Asia, especially in the East. I think every game is really exciting, and yeah, I think we're in for another really good round coming up.
All right, then. And I think from group stage match day three on, some of the J-League club fixtures are affected by the fixtures that change because of concerns about the coronavirus. But, yeah, we'll obviously worry about discussing those when they come about. But as it's transpired, yes, a match day one and a match day two have been unaffected for the J1 teams in the ACL, and that's great. So, yes, that's to look forward to this midweek. Now it's time to officially begin the Quextravaganza, and we do so with a series of questions from Ayan Sharif, at Ayan Sharif 2 on Twitter, gentlemen. So, the first one is an interesting question. That's obviously why I'm leading with it. Ayan asks, which club do you think will be the biggest movers on the table compared to last year? So, Dan, I'll throw to you first from the 2019 standings. Which club will be, better or worse, much better or much worse than compared to last year?
Well, better or worse, I don't think that any club is going to be worse enough to be that big a mover. I think that, I don't know, I'm thinking Urawa, or maybe, yeah, I think Urawa might be the biggest mover up. I think that, well, actually, no. Who's going to be the biggest mover? I guess Kashiwa are going to be the biggest mover.
I was wondering if either of you were going to choose them. Yes, it's a bit cheeky, but I'll allow it.
Yeah, I think that you look at them, I don't think that Kashiwa are ever really meant to be a J2 club for long. Obviously, their squad is of J1 quality. They just had a very, 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 very bad 2018, and with Nelsinho back at the helm, a very experienced manager who understands the J1, I see them finishing no lower than 9th or 10th.
Okay, yeah, I guess so. Technically from 19th, in inverted commas, winning J2 last year, then, finishing in the top half of the table would be quite a leap. Not as obviously as big as the one they did in 2011, Dan, but yes, a lot of people have, Kashiwa on their mind, not only for a top half finish, but, finishing a lot higher up the table. Sam, what's your answer to this question? Much better or much worse than in 2019?
Yeah, well, I think Dan might have read my notes, because I've got pretty much exactly what he said. I agree with him. I don't think anyone that finished pretty highly last season is going to drop off too dramatically. And I think Reds because they were so poor domestically last season, they can only improve. And Leonardo, even in the first game against Sendai, scored twice, should have had almost had a third, but for a slight push. So he could be the difference maker if him and Kuroki get together. Plus, there are so many good players in that Reds team that just underperform. So, yeah, they should move up. And I've got Kashua as high as third in my 2020 J-Pred, which may be a little bit bold, but I think Kashua have got so much talent. They shouldn't have been in J2, and I think they'll run the table pretty well as well. I'm just trying to think if there are any team that could drop. And I suppose it's quite tight, I think, going into that top 10 or so. You could see if anyone gets off to a slow start, as Kashima seem to be, they're sort of struggling with this new manager to get the right kind of style together. I think they could be one that drops from third down to eighth, maybe as low as eighth, but I don't see any larger drop than that.
I was thinking, Kashima, as you were saying that, I think that if Zago doesn't get off to a good start, if the wheels come off, if they have to replace him in the middle of the season, I think that they could finish in the bottom half of the table easily. That wouldn't surprise me at all. I think their club is going through sort of a massive rebuilding phase, and Kashima have always done well to avoid the worst of the aftershocks from those sorts of rebuilding projects. But right now, it looks kind of grim.
All right. Well, Dan, if your forecast there for a possible forecast there for Antlers is true, you might be going some way towards answering Ayan's next question, which was who will be the first manager to get sacked. So yeah, if Kashima start slowly and the board get itchy trigger fingers, Mr. Zago could be shown the door fairly swiftly.
Yeah, I think that he'd be up there. I feel like Nagoya Grampus have to be getting a little impatient with Ficadenti. He seems like a good candidate. I think S-Pulse will be patient with Klamovsky.
Yeah.
I think that if Ange taught the league anything, it's that you have to be patient with foreign managers who are implementing a radical system. So I think that they'll give him at least a year to get settled. I think that in the end, either Zago or Ficadenti are probably on the shortest leashes coming into the season.
Yeah, I think I agree with you with Zago, but I'd probably put in Kim Munghui from Sagantosu. I just think I can't see them having a very good season at all. I think they might go on a fairly long losing streak, or at least be in the bottom three fairly consistently throughout this season. I think they might try and change it just to get some sort of bounce. I think they're one of, if not the worst team in the league, so I think he could be on the chopping block, which is maybe unfair. I don't think he's got a lot to work with there. But, yeah, I'd see them trying to change something up just to try and provide some sort of spark to that club.
I wonder if they aren't in a situation similar to Thespa Kusatsu Gunma when they got relegated, 3-ish years back, when they couldn't really afford to sack their manager. Or actually, at the time, they didn't have anyone with an S-Class license to replace him. But, I mean, Sagantosu are in such dire straits financially with DHC pulling out as the sponsor that, I don't know, maybe Kim's the only one they have left.
Yeah, it's a fair point. They've already reappointed him once, so maybe he is just the safe pair of hands to guide them through kind of this tumultuous period in their history.
Yes, indeed. Well, I was looking through the teams in last year's table, and it's kind of hard to imagine any of the other managers other than the ones that you've both referenced there, because most managers to me seem fairly secure in their jobs, or they've just arrived, and you would expect them to be given a decent amount of time, perhaps. In the exception of Mr. Zago at Kashima, if things turn pretty ordinary from the get-go. My kind of left-field shout for this question from Ayan might be at Tsuneyasu Miyamoto at Gunbar Osaka. We know that There's a lot of buzz in preseason about Gumba after obviously signing Gen Shoji and another full season of Takashi Usami, Yosuke Taguchi's back at the club, etc., etc. But remember that Gumba have made absolutely woeful starts to the past two seasons under Miyamoto before steadying the ship in the second half of the season. And I mean, as far as I'm concerned, finishing seventh, it looks good on paper for Gumba last season, but basically that was again due to a late surge of victories, and basically they finished the same amount of points from the bottom of the table as they did to third in the table. So seventh is kind of a false position as far as I can see, with so many clubs bunched up together. So yeah, if Gumba start very slowly again, and again that's not necessarily a likely proposition, but if they do, then maybe it won't be a third time lucky for Miyamoto. He might be actually shown the door this time, but I know he obviously does have a lot of support behind the scenes at Gumba, so I think things would have to go especially badly for any talk of him to get the sack would surface, but you never know. So that's two questions down, and we might as well just crack on, guys, and finish off Ayan's last two questions. Which off-season signing will have the biggest impact on their team? That's a very interesting question, and Sam, I'll throw that straight to you first.
Well, I could just be safe and just go with my tried and trusted Douglas, because he's already started very well for Kobe with two goals in two games. I'm going to go, though, with Tarek Ilyanusi for Shonan. He's kind of an off-the-cuff, kind of a weird signing for Shonan, because he's their only foreign player, but he's got good experience at international level for Norway, and that squad is quite average, but he's like the kind of X factor that they kind of need up front. They need him to score goals. So he might be the most important signing in terms of how well he does could shape how well Shonan do. But I think, they're looking to him to score goals. And I think if he can hit his straps, as he has done in Europe, mainly in like Norway, Sweden, but I think that could be a very important signing for Shonan. Just keep their heads above water.
Okay, Dan, which off-season signing have you got pegged as making the biggest impact on their new team?
I'm going to play it safe, much, much, much safer, and say Leonardo at Urawa. I think that just he impressed very much in his first game. Obviously, the Levan Cup is not the place where reputations are decided, but if he keeps that form up, I easily think that he'll be Urawa's best player this season, best attacker this season, certainly, and that's sort of what they need. Like, Kuroki has, he scores goals, but, if they can get a 20-goal dynamo, then that's, what Urawa have sort of been missing these last couple seasons. So if he does well, I think that in a way that their fortunes are tied to his. If he does well, I think that Urawa will do well.
All right, sounds good to me. And, in honour of Ayan, who I know is an FC Tokyo supporter, I'll go for Leandro from FC Tokyo as the biggest impact on their team. I think, he offers something special, something that Tokyo haven't had in the past. And if he can stay fit and, stay firing, then he might he might have a huge say in FC Tokyo again, battling for the J1 title in 2020. Certainly hoping so. The final question from Ayan is, how do you think overall attendance will fare compared to last year? So a much broader question, Dan. A lot, I suppose, could hinge on which teams do well out of the gate, and also on the prospects of the Olympic team, both before and after the Olympics, depending on how well the team does and how overall interest in football itself is going in the country.
This is tough. This is really tough, because I think that to decide your answer to this question, you have to look at the biggest teams in terms of attendance and where their fortunes lie. So it comes down to Yokohama, F. Marinos, FC Tokyo, Urawa Reds, and Nagoya Grampus, although not in that order. I think that if Tokyo do well, because they cracked 30,000 for the first time last season, that was very big for the club. If they do well and they can build 30,000 plus fans every game, then attendance should go up overall. I think that the league even has a good shot of clearing 21,000, which I don't think they did last year. They got close, but they didn't do it. But especially if Tokyo struggle, you know, mid-table or so, even like between, say, fourth and sixth place, if Urawa can't turn things around, then I think that the J-League won't be able to stay, or the J1, I should say, won't be able to stay above 20,000. I think that it comes down to that.
Okay, fair enough then. All right, so Ayan, thank you very much for all four of your questions. And yes, you are top batter on part one of the J1 Quick Extravaganza. Thanks to Sam and Dan for their answers to Ayan's questions. And now, with that first batch of questions answered, it's time to throw to my chat with Scott McIntyre, recorded on Sunday night. We interrupt our regularly scheduled podcast to bring you a very special guest. It's my great pleasure to welcome Scott McIntyre back to J-Talk. Scott, how are you?
Hello, Mr. Maxwell. I'm I'm better now than I was a couple of weeks ago. Firstly, thanks for your support. I heard when I was released from jail, these are words I never thought I'd say, but I had a lot of podcasts to catch up on, and I went through all the podcasts that I missed out on. So thanks for the kind words that you had, the kind words that Stuart and John had on the J2 podcast, the Extra Time podcast as well, and thanks for all the support. I've got a lot of messages of support from people in and around the football community, right across the world, but a lot of those here in Japan as well. So all really really gratefully received, and sorry I couldn't be on for the last pod of last season. I was otherwise engaged. It was like going back 30 years in time. The only way I could find results about what was happening is they'd give you once a day, they'd bring the Yomiuri Shimbun in, and it would go around from cell to cell. So I was anxiously awaiting the delivery of this paper. It's got mostly baseball results in it. Just even on the final day of the season, it only had a little tiny little thing. Mariners have won here, and here's the score and the scorers. So that's unfortunately, that's how I found out about how last season ended. But just thanks again for your support and the support of everyone in the football community.
It was obviously it took a lot of people by surprise when the news broke that you were
It took me by surprise.
Of course it did. Of course it did. Yes, I fully understand that. But I mean, obviously, a lot of people weren't aware of the situation that you were suffering through, and indeed do continue to have to deal with not being able to see your kids, and that is especially tragic. And obviously. We don't want to rehash all of that. People by now know the situation, I'm sure. But just a couple of things I have to say. I mean, the way you spoke after your sentence was handed down outside court, I think a lot of us were just amazed at the composure that you had and the clarity of thought to be able to make your point so clearly and so eloquently. Obviously, I mean, I could be a bit crass and say, had 45 days to practice what you were going to say, but
no drinking for 2 months, that helps you as well.
Indeed, obviously I've got tons of questions about what happened, but the words that you spoke, and then the Foreign Correspondents Club as well obviously it must have been surreal because you're a journalist yourself, and I'm sure you've been to that facility a few times, but to be sat on the other side of the desk and have to deliver a message about this cause that is so important to you and to thousands of other parents Japanese parents and obviously foreign nationals as well. It must have obviously continues to be something that you're dealing with on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and it's a message that in this particular forum is probably going to hold a lot of currency as well, because I imagine that yeah, a lot of your listeners are probably either currently involved, have been involved, or may be involved in the future in a relationship with a Japanese person, and that relationship may at some point in time lead to having children, and therefore anyone who's in that situation needs to be completely aware of the rather barbaric family law situation in Japan that after divorce and indeed not even after but during divorce proceedings are basically entirely permits the erasure and the removal of one parent completely out of their child's lives, and in most of these cases, as was the case in mine, and my children were abducted by my partner, and I went to the police on numerous occasions. I've been to the court on numerous occasions, and nothing happened. I mean, I got no action, I got nowhere. I've spoken to dozens of various government agencies and all sorts of people, and then when you try and then ascertain, the actual whereabouts of your children, that, I'd been denied any form of information for months and months and months. And then, to have the police come and arrest you, when all you're trying to do is find out if your children are alive or dead is particularly harsh and brutal as well. But the main problem is the fact that Japan stands alone amongst the G20 nations of being the only nation, and indeed one of the few nations on earth, that doesn't allow for joint custody of children after separation or divorce. And in my opinion, this encourages abductions of children. There's lawyers that are actively involved in basically coaching people how to abduct children. It's my belief that that's what happened in my case as well, that there was active involvement of a lawyer prior to their actual abduction, advising on what should be done, and then they were hidden effectively after by various apparatus as well. So I've called it before, and I say it again, it's state-sponsored abduction because it involves all forms of Japanese legal areas, bureaucratic areas, political areas, and it's a really horrible thing. And the thing is that it can happen to anyone at any time. All you need to do is have children with a Japanese partner. You have a little argument one day, and the other partner goes, and then when they go, that's it. Your children are abducted, and as it currently stands, you have no recourse whatsoever. If this happens anywhere else in the world, there's immediate investigations done, and in many cases the people that are abducting the children are the ones that are getting put in jail, not the victims of these abductions. So what I want to say is to anyone who's involved with a Japanese man or woman, you need to be careful, and this is the reality of the situation, because you don't know when it can happen to you, and it can happen to you at any time, any point, without asking. I've unfortunately, through this situation, I've got to know hundreds of parents, predominantly Japanese, but many foreigners as well. And in almost all of our cases, we never saw it coming. Suddenly one day they're not there, and that's the end of the story. You can never get your children back. So it's an issue that should, and I should say, over 70% of parents that are removed from children never see them again for the rest of their lives. So this is an issue that should be of really great and grave concern, no matter how great you currently think your relationship is with your Japanese partner. All it takes is one little argument, one little disagreement. They're gone, boof, and that's it, end of story. So we need as many voices and as much support as we can to try and fight the cause for joint custody in Japan, which is, it's not the Muromachi period anymore. So you would think that's a fairly logical concept to most people. So, we need to make that message loud and clear to rather vocal opponents, unfortunately, of it in Japan, and certainly a large number of politicians who are unfortunately feeding off the vote of, in inverted commas, single mother support groups, which in my opinion, the bulk of these women are actually criminals who've kidnapped their children, and not only did they not deserve any support, but they deserve widespread condemnation. But unfortunately, they're a very large voting base for the Liberal Democratic Party here, and much money is funneled through to these organizations. Much money is funneled through to various other organizations that are set up, in inverted commas, to protect women from violence and abuse. And, of course, I'm not disputing that happens. But in my Yeah, opinion, and that's based on a lot of research. A lot of these organizations are merely set up to further enhance and support the kidnapping and abduction of children, which is a really tragic and criminal event. And the only way to stop this and to stop these people from abducting children and to stop anyone who might be listening to the podcast falling victim to this in the future is to simply change the laws and have joint custody, and then there will be no more abductions after this. So any support from people in Japan, there's going to be a march in March. I'll happily, Ben, I'll pass on the details about that. Anyone who could come down and join in this march for joint custody would be greatly appreciated. And any other kind of, public or private support as well, would also be greatly appreciated, because it's such a simple thing. We want children to grow up knowing two parents. Unfortunately, the only way to do that in Japan and to ensure that happens is to change the laws here and make sure we have joint custody. So that's what we're fighting to do.
And more power to yourself, Scott. And I'm sure you've made some really amazing connections with other affected parents throughout the course of the last, almost 9 months now, isn't it? So I'll obviously happily spread the word, and I'm sure, the listeners as well will be retweeting their guts out as we spread the word about this, and we don't want this to die down. And now that you're out, obviously we want the perfect world is for you to be reunited with Hinata and Haruko, and someday we hope that will happen for you, mate. Because it's been as I said on the podcast. Last year, I mean, it's just incredible to me, and I've got so much respect for you the way you've dealt with this, because I don't know how I would be able to absolutely.
I mean, you could probably get better odds on Gainari Tottori winning a J1 before I'm going to be reunited with my children, unfortunately. But what we want to do is we want to fight to prevent the next wave of parents and children having to go through this. And the only way it's going to happen is by changing the law. And it's what we simply need to do.
Yes, mate. All right. Well, I'm sure you're chomping at the bit to talk some J1. That was obviously something you weren't able to do too much for 45 days or so while you were detained.
I did meet a few football fans actually inside, which was it was good to have something in common. I mean, one guy in particular, I forgot what particular offence he was in there for, but he was a really big football fan, and we did spend a little bit of time talking about the J League. So it was a nice distraction.
Oh well, that's. I'm glad to hear that. But I'll tell you what. We'll segue into our J1 chat, and whether you're unveiling your hashtag JPred here or not, Scott. Before the season starts on the 21st, I'll throw you a question. Obviously, this is the J1 Quextravaganza that your bit is being inserted into. So a brand new Patreon supporter has come on board on Sunday evening, Scott. His name is Kevin, and he sent through a bunch of questions for this podcast, I'll be getting to the rest of them with Sam and Dan. But there's one in particular that I wanted to ask you, Scott, and it's about the new S-Pulse manager, Peter Klimovsky. So Kevin asks, is Peter Klimovsky's Japanese good, and how does his Japanese compare to other foreign managers past and present in Japan? And has language skill helped other foreign managers succeed, in your opinion? So firstly, the new S-Pulse boss, Peter Klimovsky, how's his Japanese?
I know Peter quite well. And he's, first and foremost, he's a lovely guy. secondly, he's an exceptionally brilliant coach. Was the guy that did pretty much all of the actual on-field coaching in terms of taking the practice sessions during the week not just at Yokohama, even prior to this, during the long time that he had with Ange. And he's going to be a fantastic addition to Shimizu if he's given the time to implement what needs to be implemented. He's already... calling this the football kingdom down in Shizuoka, the kind of fallen kingdom. We know for a long time it was the cradle of Japanese football. So many great players have come from that region, and he's really passionately committed to bringing back that whole football kingdom. It's going to take a while to do it. We saw in the Levain Cup this weekend some little elements of that. You know, the scoreboard wasn't the best reflection of it, but I think if you look at the way that the goal that they scored was constructed, it was very similar to a lot of the goals that Marinos were scoring for fun last year. I think it's a really good glimpse of what is going to come of this Espol side when he gets things together. And you know, he's got a transfer window in the middle of the year, another one at the end of the year. And you know, I'm not saying that they're going to be a title contenders this year. I think they're going to struggle for a long part this year. But once he's got things in place, I think, we can come back for 2021 and hopefully look at Shimizu, I think, as being a really serious contender to win the league, because this guy is an exceptional football coach. I've spent, you know, many a coffee with him, you know, listening and learning from him. And, you know, it's like, for me as a journalist, I feel like I've got a PhD in football, you know, just from being around this guy and listening to him, because he's such a smart guy, and he's gonna be a fantastic coach. Let's not forget, this is his first you know, full-time head coaching kind of role, so it's new to him, you know, taking on the other aspects outside of just being on the pitch. But he's going to be wonderful, and one of the great things he's done, getting back to that question, is he's making a commitment to learn Japanese. We saw in his introductory press conference, he did that in Japanese. He's got a few younger children. His son, I think, now is going to a Japanese nursery, and he's picking up Japanese quite well. So I'm sure Pete picking up someone to bounce off. But he does take lessons, I believe, once a week as well. And he's committed to making an effort to learning Japanese, which I think so few foreigners do. We've seen, you know, guys that do it down the years. Gert Engels, of course, former Urawa Kyoto coach, the Kobe assistant the last year. He's been here for quite a while. He speaks fluent Japanese. The new Gifu coach, of course, his name I'm going to butcher if I attempt to pronounce it. He also speaks fluent Japanese. And there's no question, I think it helps in getting jobs, right? I mean, if you can do this without a translator, even, you know, the connections and the contacts you need to get jobs is not the easiest thing. You know, it's not often done on merit. And then, of course, Ben, who can forget our most beloved Japanese-speaking coach last year, the one and only Jan Jonsson, the ex Shimizu guy who Pete, you know, not directly took over, but was there for the start of a last season. And he was really famous, wasn't he, for kind of, in a high-octane kind of stream of consciousness jazz riffery of going between English and Japanese seemingly without any rhyme or reason. And that was a highlight of many a weekend for me, listening to those press conferences. So, yeah, I would like to see more foreign coaches make an effort. You know, we've seen guys who've been in the league for a long time, and as far as I can ascertain, they don't really speak more than a couple of words of Japanese. So, you know, it's obviously easy if you set up, you've got a translator with you everywhere to do everything, and, you know, maybe a lot of them don't have too much time to devote to learning the language. But, yeah, certainly back on Pete, he's absolutely committed to learning Japanese. You know, he thinks it's a thing he should be doing. You know, it's a responsibility being in the country. That applies, of course, not just in football, but in any walk of life. But he's told me that he is planning to do as much of his interviews as he can in Japanese. He will, and then as that increases more and more, you'll see more and more of it. His translator is a lovely guy as well, so you don't want to put him out of a job. That he was the same translator that that my old mate Mark Milligan had when he was back at Jeff Chiba. So you don't want to put him out of a job either. But yeah, I think it's great to see Pete making a real commitment to trying to learn language. But even more importantly than that, this guy is an absolutely an outstanding football mind, an outstanding football person, someone, obviously, you know, how I view the game. So we share very similar philosophies on that. And what you're going to see at Shimizu, and what we've seen already, even in this one game in the cup where they got soundly beaten by an excellent team in Kawasaki, was a commitment to playing the way that he wanted them to play. And it's a question first of getting the belief into the players, the courage to play this way, because we keep saying it's very easy to play, reactively and set up to be very difficult to beat and take your 1-0 wins here, there and everywhere. But I think that region, Shimizu, is a region that appreciates positivity, that appreciates up-tempo attacking football. You know, there's the region was built on this style of game. So he wants to bring this back. He wants to bring the kingdom back. So I think it's going to be really fascinating at times to watch. And you've seen Ben. Did you notice they've rebranded themselves this year as well?
Mm, yeah. Yes, indeed, yes.
In following on from what are we calling our friends up on the Northern Ireland these days? They're the Hokkaido Consadole Sapporo, and now we've got, what is it, Shizuoka Shimizu S-Pol. So, geez, you got to hope that not more of these clubs are just going on all these territorial expansions, or it's going to get a real mess with all these club names going on. But, yeah, I think it's going to be a struggle for Shimizu, I think, at first. They've got a new foreign signing that I think will be announced on Monday. A guy, I think his name's Carlinhos, coming in from the Swiss leagues, who I understand Peter's been tracking for a long time, and is the exact kind of player that he's targeted to fit into the way that he wants to play, which is good. And then I think, yeah, in the middle of the year, we could see some exciting signings from other parts, maybe of Asia and beyond as well, which would be good too. So it's going to be a difficult 6 months. So I think everyone is aware of that for Shimizu. And if the club believes in the vision, then they have to stick with the course, because to play the kind of football that Marinos is playing, now we hear everyone wants to play like this. You know, this was it took a long time to put the seeds down, to water it and to get it fully flowering, and that's the only way. There are no shortcuts, and there is no cutting of corners. So it simply takes some struggle to get there. And you know, it wouldn't surprise anyone. I think if Shimizu were battling somewhere down the lower reaches of the table come summer, but I think you'll see a really big improvement over the back end of this season, and then you'll see a superb improvement next year. And why can't they be the 2021 J-League champions?
Wow, okay. Well, yeah, I bet the hair on the back of Barry Velder's neck has just been standing up for the last 5 or 6 minutes while you talk about Pete Klimovsky and the project he is trying to install at Shimizu S-Pulse. And well, yeah, if you're a Shimizu supporter listening, you should be genuinely optimistic. If as Scott says, the board and the front office give Klimovsky time to allow his methods to bed in and really start to bear fruit, because obviously we know what happened with Yokohama. Now Klimovsky's ex-team, of course, where he was assistant to Ange Postecoglou, finished the 12th in their first season, just goal difference outside of the promotion relegation spot. And then lo and behold, the next season, which just happened to be last season, of course, they were crowned a J1 champions. And as Scott said, as he predicted, pretty much all the way throughout the 2018 season. So, there you go. You can be positive about the future if you're an S-Pol supporter listening to the pod. Thanks for your question about the Klimovsky, Kevin. And actually, by now, this point of the podcast, the rest of your questions might have indeed been answered by the time we get to this section with Scott. So, we might segue off Shimizu, Scott, and talk about their opponents in the first round of the Levain Cup. That was about as much as I hoped to dedicate to the Levain Cup in this week's podcast. So, you mentioned they were battered by Kawasaki Frontale in the first round of the group stage of the Levain Cup. And, before we started recording, you mentioned you were especially impressed with their preseason. So where do they sit in your preseason top six? I imagine very, very close to the top.
Well, just firstly, this is one of the few times that you can get excited about the Levain Cup, because it's come almost as the final preseason match this year. But I don't know the reason why. I'm assuming it's because of the Olympics. But I think this is the way that it should be done every year. And indeed, you'd even push it further and do the first two games of this cup before and use them as de facto preseason games. Because what we saw in these games was pretty much everyone played their pretty much close to their first 11. So it was, it was like, what do the Americans call this? The season minus one, the game minus one, or whatever it was. So, yeah, I think fascinating games, and certainly a real lot of cues to be taken from this, because, yeah, like I said, it was basically the strongest 11s going, minus the ACL clubs were going, and of course featuring Matsumoto Yamaga, but we won't get into that again. But yeah, it was actually quite a thrilling round of the Levain Cup. But Kawasaki, they haven't been shy in basically coming out and saying they're looking to replicate what Marinos have done. On the evidence of this absolute demolition, they're going to be very, very, very hard to stop. They've basically, dropped into this the exact same system with the kind of the four defenders, the three central midfielders, the two wider players, and the one man up front, which I think suits them far better. You know, we said all throughout last season, why the hell Leandro Damian isn't a regular starter, was a mystery, but under this system, he certainly appears to be the focal point of the attack with what we imagine, although he came off the bench today and did quite well for himself as well. But Kobayashi on the right, either Saito or Hasegawa on the left, and then that the midfield three, you've got you know, a hell of a choice. So many great players who can fit in there. The Jessiel in the back is a fine defender. You know, Jung is a serviceable keeper. But I think going forward, yeah, they're going to be a real treat. We saw Wakizaka playing in one of the central roles today. Miyashiro, who didn't get much time last year, started out wide on the right. He looked very impressive as well. So they've got some fine young players coming through. And now this commitment to you know, really pressing high and hard from the front, trying to win possession as quickly as they can. And then, you know, we just know how dangerous they are, the technical capabilities of the players that have played together for such a long time. In if we say in some way the injury to Kengo Nakamura has allowed this to happen, because I don't know if he would have completely fit too well into the system, and you know, he's getting on and not quite as mobile as what this system requires, and you know, the fact that he's going to be out probably until the summer allows it to be easier to implement without that presence of you know, the legend of the club and what to do with him and where to fit him in. You know, as we've seen with what's going on with Endor at Gumber and various other occasions as well. So I think they're going to be very, very hard to beat at the moment. I've got it Yokohama 1, Kawasaki 2, but they're basically a 1A and a 1B for me, because Marinos have to contend with the ACL. I think they're going to do very well in that. We saw them really put on an excellent showing over in Korea last week. You know, this is the great thing about Ange and, you know, these guys now, Pete, the guys that are coming off. I should also mention the other two Australian assistants that are at Marinos as well. Arthur Pappas, another guy I know very well, has coached in India, he's coached in Saudi Arabia, he's coached in Australia. He's also an excellent coach. And now he's basically stepped into the number two duties, which means he's now the guy doing basically, you know, most of the actual on-field coaching during the weekend. And he's brought in another guy who is a really promising young Australian coach as well, Sean Ontong, the former captain of the Australia under-20 team, who was, another really smart young coach on the rise. So what Ange is doing is, you know, he's also grooming these coaches to then go off and you know, be fine coaches in their own right. And it's, you know, it's highly conceivable, I think, within a couple of years that we could see four or five Australian coaches in the league. You know, maybe Australia hasn't produced the kind of top quality players that a lot of people from our country, I would have wanted, but what we have a fantastic record in is producing brilliant coaches. In I've said it before, I think Ange is one of the top five coaches anywhere on the planet. It's an absolute a crime that he's not being given the, you know, the chance to go somewhere at a big league in England, Spain or Germany and show what he can do. Because I spent a bit of time with him on Friday at the annual kickoff conference that the J-League does, and we talked about that. I said, you know, do you feel that you deserve a chance? And he said, yes, absolutely, I do. You know, he said, you know, and he wasn't being boastful. He was just being honest. He said, you know, I watch these games and think there's nothing there that's happening that I can't do. And he said, I know I will succeed. If, you know, if I was handed a chance at the Premier League. But, yeah, unfortunately, the passport often is the barrier to that. So the beneficiaries of that are fans of Japanese football. It's great to see too much in Australia that you can actually watch the games down, Optusport down in Australia this year, the J-League, which is great.
Yeah, brilliant.
But to have someone like Ange here is an absolute treat, because he is he's absolute coaching royalty, and the guys he's got below him now in Arthur and Sean Ontong are brilliant coaches in their own right, and Pete now has a chance to go out on his own in Shimizu, and you know, there'll be little tweaks here or there, but these guys all come from the same ideology, the same philosophy, and it's so exciting and thrilling for the J-League to have the kind of guys in place. And what it's done is getting back to the Kawasaki question, is then say, okay, Kawasaki, because this is a template of what we need to do. So now what we wait is, what are Yokohama going to do? We talked with Ange as well, and he said, you know, he doesn't know. Football takes him to places, the game takes him to places that he doesn't know where it's going to go. The players take him to places where it doesn't, you know, it's not mapped out. But he said, you know, something will evolve, and you know, we'll do something different this year, and keep the side moving and coming up with new ideas. So how do they react? Because I think not just Frontale, I think you're going to see a lot of teams reacting in a similar way. We saw Reds setting up in a similar way, and they were outstanding in the Levain Cup. They've been absolutely brilliant in pre-season, and I'll get to my JPRED in a minute, but I can tell you they're very, very high up there as well. So we're going to see a lot of teams trying to copy the Marinos template, which I think is a great thing. It's a great credit to Ange. And of all the clubs that are perfectly equipped to do it, Kawasaki are the ones, right, because they've already got such a fine collection of technically gifted players. As I said, I think the system works much better with the way that they are setting up. And, yeah, they're going to be very, very hard to beat, and they're going to score a hell of a lot of goals along the journey.
All right, then. So, yeah, I guess you're well and truly on the record with your thoughts about Yokohama and their, yeah, winning the league last year obviously vindicated your prediction. So you're expecting, you've already teased it, you have them at the top of your prediction at the moment. So you're expecting basically the last 11 games of last season to be just a springboard for perhaps a period of dominance, because, I mean, you know, they were fifth after 23 games last year, and that was a lot better than they were in 2018, but it was still, 7 or 8 points off top spot, 6 or 7 points off top spot, and then they clicked and they swept all before them and were deservedly champions, and they finished 6 points clear, and nobody could argue with that at the end of the day. But so you're expecting that, yeah, the last 2 or 3 months of last season will just instill that sort of winning mentality, that confidence in the players that they'll just carry forward into this season. So you're expecting them to repeat as champions.
Yeah, because you look at the amount of players that arrived at the start of last season, right? Park came in, Tiraton came in, Edgar came in, Marcos came in, Endo was basically into the team for the first time. So it was, virtually half the team was turned over again at the start of last season. So naturally that's going to take time. He's got the kind of players that he wants to fit the way that he's going to play, but still it takes the time to integrate them. And the great thing for Marinos is they haven't lost anyone that they didn't want to lose, basically. So it's essentially the same team that now completely knows the way that they're expected to play and are clearly so capable of executing it. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be very hard to stop them. The return of Edgar as well, of course, my tip for the Golden Boot last year, which, I'll give you that one if you give me the other one with the Tosu.
Oh, jeez.
Thing. So having him back, he's probably not going to be fully fit for another month or two, but when he does, I mean, he's going to be, almost like a new signing in a way as well. Eric really came on in his little stint there. The only player that they've lost that they would have liked to keep, I guess, is Mateus, who scored an absolute belter in the Louvain Cup. It was far too much pizzazz for Mr. Figadenti. He probably didn't know what to do with himself. But, a great winner. So he's going to be a good player for Grampus. But, he may not have even started at Marinos the way that things are. So, yeah, I mean, really, what's going to slow them down? The ACL is one kind of distraction. But, the players are very fit. It's essentially the same squad as last year. They know the way to play and what they were doing. They've taken that first 6 months to get up to pace, and here they are. And I think from here on in, it's going to be a machine that's very hard to stop. I think there's a clear top two, and then there's quite a gap to the next lot. And I think Yokohama and Kawasaki will be going toe-to-toe for long parts of the season. And it may indeed come down to who takes the title in terms of who takes the two games between these two clubs. They're in my opinion, clearly heads and shoulders, the best two teams in the league. And I expect them to be battling things out.
All right, then. So, yeah, you've set your stall out there. Yokohama 1 and Kawasaki 2 in your JPRED. So you said before we started recording you had the entire table mapped out. I will spare the listeners having to sit through all of that. But I tell you what, Scott, if you wouldn't mind, could you please give us, firstly, your top six? So from third down, we already know your top two.
Okay, so I've got Urawa in third, and I think if anyone was to challenge those top two, I think the only team, the team that I've got in fourth as well. So I've got Kashiwa in fourth. So I think these are the two teams that have the potential to challenge those top two. I would have Gamba in there, who I've got at sixth. But I'm just not convinced that Miyamoto is the coach to get what should be coming out of this team. Brilliant young players great experience, goal scoring, players all over the place, you know, now probably the best defense in the league. I mean, everything is there on paper for Gamba to do well, but everything has been there on paper for Gamba to do well for several seasons. And I'm just not sure if Miyamoto is the guy. I think he's had more than enough time now. He's got certainly the players that he wants, but for some reason he just hasn't been able to turn this team into the force that they should be. So if things start poorly for Gamba and I think within 6 to 8 weeks they need to make a change at that point, and if they get the right coach in to take over and really unleash the team, then I'll reconsider my thoughts on Gamba. But at the moment I've got them sixth. I've got Kashima in fifth, but that's a fading fifth because they've been really ordinary in preseason. Obviously they lost the playoff to Melbourne. They struggled again today in the cup. They'd be, as you would expect, against Nagoya, dominated possession and chances, but couldn't find a way to break them through. A real heavy turnover at the club. It's very unusual for Kashima. Usually, they'll lose one or two kind of big name players will go to Europe, but the nucleus of the squad stays in place. That's changed. I personally thought it was a very harsh decision to get rid of Go Oiwa. I thought he'd done fantastically well. We talked a lot about it. The issues with the schedule, the fact that they were in the Club World Cup twice, they went all the way and won the ACL. It meant they hadn't had a break, and I think he'd really handled that situation admirably. So it's a big call to replace him with Mr. Zagor, who needs to learn Japanese football. He needs to learn the squad. He's going to, on paper, rely heavily on Juan Alano, the right winger, and Everaldo, the striker, who have come in, neither of which particularly set the world on fire early on. And remembering the guy in Serginho who did so well that they need to replace. So, I can see Kashima actually slipping a little bit more than fifth. And indeed, the pressure could be on Antlers if things go a little bit wobbly early in the season as well. What do they do, with the coach? Because they've invested heavily in getting these foreign players in. They've invested heavily in the coach himself. And when you do that, you expect instant results. And not being in the ACL group stage is a hammer blow. I think they're going to start quite slowly, actually, Antlers. So it wouldn't surprise, if one of that kind of, and it's a really big crop of teams in the middle, the more organized teams, the Cerezo, Hiroshima, Nagoya, Tokyo, all these kind of teams that are going to be organized enough to win two games out of four and pick up a draw in the other if things go well. They're not going to do it in any thrilling fashion, but we saw it with Tokyo last year. If you get on a roll whilst doing that, then you can really push high up the table, and it's perhaps likely that one of that four could edge up ahead of Kashima. So as it stands, Yokohama, Kawasaki, Urawa, Kashiwa, and I think they're really only the four title contenders, the two at the top being Clear Ones and Reds and Racehall. Reds is another mystery, right? Because, again, the coach is, in my opinion, not the best option for that team. But we've seen the formation change now back to this 4-4-2. Just on paper, the players are so good. They have absolute quality in every position all around the pitch. They, very unusually, you touched on it last week, they hardly made any transfers, but the one they did make in Leonardo has the potential to be one of the greatest transfers in J-League history, in my opinion. This guy absolutely tore J3 up. He absolutely tore J2 up. He's come in, Reds played 5 preseason games. He scored in every single preseason game. In the Levain Cup, his first time officially up in J1, what does he do? 5-2, Reds, okay, they're knocking over Sendai, it's no great shakes. Boom, 2 goals straight off the bat. 9 minutes, he scored his first. Boom, 35. This guy is an absolute major contender for the Golden Boot. He's 22 years old. He's already said that he wants to play for Japan. I mean, this guy, he's not going to be eligible, I don't think, for Qatar, but the one after that, in USA, when he's whatever he is, 27 or so, 28, in the prime of his career, this guy could easily be Japan's number 9 for a long, long time. I think he's going to absolutely take the league by storm this year, and on the back of that, Reds are going to do fantastically well. The word that I'm hearing from out of the Reds camp is that they're trying to move on from a couple of veteran players. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see Makino start to be phased out of the picture defensively this year. He wasn't selected in the team today. Neither was Koroki in the starting 11. there's a lot of boardroom shenanigans going on at Reds. There's a new board in place from what I understand of it. Mr. Otsky doesn't have the support of influential people in that board, and so there's tension there, and he needs to save his own job to make a flying start, and to do that, you know, there maybe needs some not sentimentality, because, you know, both Makino and Kuroki are fine players, but I think there's been a conscious decision to change the formation and to put a new identity on the team, and certainly, yeah, from what I'm hearing, Makino's position in particular is very much under threat, and I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't start too many games, certainly over the early part of this season, and I wouldn't surprise me if Kuroki was in the same boat as well. So it's a new philosophy, it's a new look, it's a new system, it's a new approach. The question is now, can Otsky be the guy to guide it? Or what he's shown throughout preseason is that everything he's done is absolutely spot on. And the arrival of Leonardo, as I said, this really has the potential to be one of the biggest transfers in a long, long time in the J-League. I think this guy's a very, very good player. And he's really going to impress this year.
All right, then. So maybe new listeners might be surprised to hear Scott confidently predict Urawa, who finished 14th in J1 last year, just a point outside the promotion relegation spot, as a candidate for a top three finish. But, of course, you more experienced listeners and the followers of Japanese football know that, Yokohama went from 12th to 1st last year. And, in the last 10 years, we've got two examples of clubs coming up from J2 as champions and then going on the following season to win the J1 title. And, Scott, you seem confident in Kashiwa as well. They'll be up in fourth in your prediction. We'll obviously have time throughout the season to get your thoughts on them and other clubs. But before we let you go, I just wanted to get your thoughts on a couple of teams before your projected bottom three. So from your top six there, you obviously don't have the club that we both support, FC Tokyo. So, in a nutshell, where do you have Tokyo finishing? And are they just going to regress, or are there other teams just going to go past them by playing the Yokohama way? I don't know, but
yes. Well, that's what I want to see. I don't know. I've got them in a collection, as I said, Cerezo, Tokyo, Hiroshima, and Grampus, somewhere in that bunch of teams that all play a similar kind of football. I've all got them bunched in the middle of the table, but it absolutely wouldn't surprise to see one of them, do far better than that, and, you know, maybe push up and get an ACL spot. But yeah, good luck in terms of guessing which one it is, because they all play such a similar, rather conservative style of football that, you know, I can't see it working for more than one of that four. It may well work for one, but I don't want to go out and kind of guess which one it is. But I think, yeah, this is also going to be the year where we really see a shift away from this in terms of being the template, which it was for such a long time. And I think we're going to see a lot more teams really try to play, say the Marinos way. I call it the Ange way, or the Ange and Pete way. A lot more exciting football. So I've got that collection of teams, including Tokyo, somewhere, you know, around the middle of the table.
All right, then. So, one more that I'm curious about, and that's Oita. Where do you have them?
I've got them in 14th. I think, such a fantastic story last year. The squad, whilst it hasn't been greatly weakened, it certainly hasn't been strengthened either. They don't have as much money as other clubs haven't really made any great signings. I mean, Daiki Watari, I'm surprised not to see him playing in the A-League or somewhere. He's a kind of perfect player for there. Keichinen showed, some kind of promise at Frontale, but he's not, I don't think, the number nine to be scoring you 15 to 20 goals. By the way, look at the strikers we've got this year. The league is absolutely blessed in terms of, particularly the foreign guys. But Takashi Usami, by the way, has been absolutely ripping the preseason to shreds as well. I think he may have scored in every game that Gamba played as well. He's been fantastic. So this could be his year. But if we look at Damian, Leonardo, I've already said, from Reds, Jaya, who scored in the cup today, if he can stay fit and get an extended run, could be brilliant. The Marinos guys, Douglas at Kobe, who could score 1,000 goals, Alunga at Kashua. So there's so many you know, really good number nines. And then you look at Kei Chinen leading the line alongside Daiki Watari in behind giving him the service. I just don't think Oi to have the quality. They've got the coach, we know, and they've got a positive philosophy, particularly away from home, to do well. But I think the other teams are just going to be too strong. So I've got them staying up, but not by much.
Okay, and can I guess your bottom three?
You can.
Okay. I think you have Tosu bottom, Yokohama FC second bottom, and Shonan 16th again.
You've got two of the three right, and you've got Tosu in the correct slot in 18th. I think I'm going to stand perhaps alone as being someone that doesn't think Yokohama FC are going to go down. I think they're going to stay up. I've got Yokohama FC in 15th, just staying up. But they've also got the potential, I think, to do a lot better than that. It's a really curious mix of senior citizens and preschool children. It's a very, very unusual situation. But certainly, you know, the three that they've got in midfield, all in their early 20s, very exciting, technically gifted players. Rokutan coming in, he looks like he's going to be the first choice. He's a steady presence. The defence is, again, steady but not spectacular. I think they've got goals in them. I think they've got goals and creativity, and I think they're going to have enough to stay up. So I've got Tosu and Shonan as the two teams going down directly, and then I've got our friends Sendai, who I should say, the new Sendai coach, Mr. Kiyama, bears a striking resemblance to the judge in my case, to the point where I was in court and I thought, holy moly, this guy reminds me of someone. And then halfway through when he's talking, I thought, fuck, it's bloody Kiyama. I've got Kiyama as the judge in my case,
wow.
Which didn't turn out well for me, and I don't think it's going to turn out well for Sendai either, having the judge in charge of them. I think they're in all sorts of – the injuries have really killed them, losing Cuenca. They brought this guy Guedes in from Portugal who'd done quite well. He's injured. Nagasawa is injured. And the squad's it's just not very good. I did have a big chat the other day with Shimel Mate, though, at this Jelly Kickoff Conference. A lovely guy. So he grew up not playing football. He told me he grew up playing basketball, and now he's dreaming of being a tennis player as well. So he's a bit of a character. So I hope he does well. But I'm not particularly keen on the judge doing well. I think Sendai are going to struggle. It wouldn't surprise if they were down there in the automatic spots as well. I think Sendai, Belmari, and Tosu are the three that are going to be in that muck to go down.
All right, fair enough. That's nice of you to be able to catch up with Shimao Mate. I think you were fairly against him signing.
Early on, absolutely yes, it was. Yes, but as the season went on.
Yeah, he did okay, didn't he?
He was the best player, clearly. versatile, and he ended up being the captain as well.
You came clean to him that, you were against him signing in the first place before, you gave him some credit for.
He told me a lot about football in Mozambique, so I got a new understanding of where he's come from. It didn't start well for him, and it was a curious signing at the point. But so was Alungra, and look what he's done. He's a JV record goal scorer in one game now. He was their best player, last year. And he's going to be an important player for them this year as well, because I think he's going to have a lot of work to do in a team that are probably going to. Probably going to ship quite a few goals. It'd be a shame to see Sendai, nice city, a lovely little stadium, great supporters and everything else, to go down. It was just such a curious appointment in the first place. I mean, you've gone from having one kind of uninspiring guy that's never really done anything to now having another kind of guy that's done very little outside of sentencing me to jail. and now being in charge of Vigelta Sendai. So... I think it was the wrong appointment, but it's one they're going to have to stick with, even if it goes badly. And Kiyama might be working his wonders back down in J2 next year.
All right. Well, there's a few more puns we could do there, but we're probably best to leave it there. And obviously you will be putting your money where your mouth is within the next few days, Scott, and going live on Twitter with your J-Pred. Mm. Obviously, your Gif for Richie,
which is what top three and
top four and bottom three. Yeah. So Gif for Richie doesn't require the entire table, although you could feel free to post that if you like with the Twitter's expansion. It's a character count. It's a possibility these days. But, so for now, obviously wanted to get this chat done and, wanted to catch up with you. And, I'm sure, the listeners will very much appreciate it as well. So, normal service is now resumed, and yeah, we'll probably even have you on the next week after the first round of matches. So yeah, terrific to catch up for now, and I look forward to doing so again very soon and numerous times throughout the season, Scott.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ben, and thanks for your support.
My absolute pleasure, mate. All right, yes, so after a quick hit of music, we'll be back with Sam and Dan. Tremendous to catch up with Scott there. And, yeah, we hope our listeners will continue to fight for his cause. Let's continue with our next few questions before we wrap up part one. The question I asked Scott, once we segued on to talking about Japanese football, again, was from Kevin on Patreon. So Kevin is a new subscriber on Patreon. Thank you very much for your support, Kevin. Julian also came on board recently, so very much appreciate the support of both of those guys. So, yeah, Kevin, your other three questions, we'll get to those now. And, yeah, they're all very interesting in their different ways. They're all very different. And, yeah, looking forward to the guys' perspectives on these. I'm not really sure if we can answer the first one, but we're going to give it a crack. Dan, Kevin's first question. When names were first put on the back of shirts, why did they go for the Latin alphabet rather than use Japanese characters, like in the K-League, where most clubs use Korean characters to obviously for the players' names?
It's a super interesting question. I actually asked Tetsuichi Utsunomiya, who's a very famous football journalist here in Japan, and he wasn't sure either. He's never heard of any decision that was made, but he surmised that it's probably because baseball clubs in Japan have forever used the Latin alphabet to show the names, and he thinks that that's just something that carried on to the J League, and to, I should say, even before then, to like the JSL and the national teams before that.
Okay, fair enough. Sam, I think you and I can agree that we're nowhere near as well connected, especially in the Japanese media, as Dan is. So, yes, if a trusted source that he's asked about the question isn't able to give a definitive answer, I don't think either of us are going to be able to provide any more information, are we?
I doubt it. I mean, I can have a guess. Like, when the league was started, they brought in a lot of these big names and trying to get exposure to the league. And then if you know Zico or, you know, Lineker or whoever it might be, you kind of, those names resonate with you. And if you can read that name in the English script or the Latin script, I think it's a little bit more accessible on a global stage. And it kind of doesn't kind of, corner off the J-League as just like a Japanese-only thing. It kind of brings it out into the wider world, but I mean, that's just a some sort of guess. I have no idea on the actual answer.
All right,
it's a fascinating question. I just want to say that that's a really cool question, and actually, I guess it sort of ties into a question that we're going to deal with later.
Indeed. So, just out of interest, I probably shouldn't ask this in the interest of time, Madame. But do you know if it's a rule in the K League that clubs have to use a Korean Hangul script for their player names, or is that a choice that some clubs do it and some clubs don't?
As far as I know, all clubs do it in domestic competitions, but they have to use Latin characters for the ACL.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So I don't know what the rule is on that. You'd have to ask the guys at the K-League United podcast to give more details.
Sure, sure. Okay, well, I'm going to throw you both for a loop here and mix up the order of Kevin's questions. He just asked about when names were first put on the back of shirts. So why don't we answer the last of Kevin's questions about the ridiculous cost of said shirts. And Dan, obviously you're the best one to ask here as well. Why are J-League kits so expensive? And when in Japan, where is the best and cheapest place to purchase them? Is it at the stadium on match day? Kevin asks.
It is absolutely not at the stadium on match day. The issue with kits being so expensive And I'll give credit in advance to Alan Gibson, noted uniform aficionado who has gone on many rants about this before. It comes down to issues of, one, supply and demand, which is that J-League clubs are not ordering shirts at the same rate as your Premier League clubs, your Liga, your La Liga clubs, or even your Italian, your Serie A clubs. And so because they're ordering them in smaller numbers, it means that they have to charge more to make up the difference and to get a profit from it. Japanese clubs do not like dealing with dead stock, so they make an effort to have as few shirts as possible left over from season to season, which is why a lot of clubs will do orders in batches. And some clubs, like Tokyo or Urawa, for example, will have uniforms available any time of the year. Other clubs, if you don't order it at the beginning of the season, you're kind of screwed. As far as the costs, I think a lot of it is that just anti-competitive pricing, let's call it, racketeering in a way, or I guess maybe not racketeering, but it's a cartel in a way, where the standard price is more or less set, and that was at a time 10,000 yen for replicas and about 15,000 yen for authentics. And that's generally where you'll see it in the J1. Umbro obviously has ridiculous prices of about 25,000 yen for their authentic shirts, which is why I refuse to purchase any Umbro authentics. But, you know, some of the smaller makers will be a bit more affordable. Nike and Adidas have more or less been pretty consistent. In the J2, you'll find shirts for much, 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 much less. As far as where is the cheapest to purchase them, you can get something I recommend to everyone, used or secondhand or vintage uniforms at Vintage Sports, which is a chain that has about a half dozen locations between Tokyo and Osaka. That's where you can find a lot of like the old school kits, which is really fun. You can go to Kamo or the club shop after the season ends, and they'll usually have discounts. To what extent sort of depends on the club, and it depends on how well or how poorly they did the previous season. But if you want cheap kits that don't break the bank, you do have to wait a little.
Yes, and waiting is something that I got used to with my FC Tokyo kits. Of course, Dan, the famous story of the first season we were in the Champions League, absolutely buzzing, ordered my kit, missed out in two different lotteries, and my kit finally arrived the day after we were knocked out in the round of 16. So, supply and demand is very much the issue here, Kevin. And, my case, I was unlucky. And, lots of other people are in the same boats. And, when it comes to the cost, mate, I probably shouldn't be recommending you do this. But, there's plenty of sites based in China that will do you a decent-looking knockoff for much cheaper, so maybe you might want to head down that route, because if you're visiting the country, you don't want to be spending a third of your budget, your daily budget, on a kit. As good as some of them do look, there's often much better ways to spend your money, Kevin. So as you know, as you've been listening to the podcast, I already asked Scott your question about Peter Klimovsky's Japanese, and Scott answered that in detail. So the last question from Kevin, I'll throw to you first, Sam. In your time watching the J-League, how have contributions of Thai players compared to contributions of Australian players? And do you foresee their influence growing? I believe their influence is related to the Thai players that have been in the J-League and might be arriving in the not-too-distant future, Sam.
Yeah, well, I think both the Thai and Aussie players, their influence should grow in the coming years or so. The Thai players, I think, have done better, at least in my time. Chanatip was in the team of the year a couple of years ago. Tiraton is a league champion last year with Marinos. He's become a very solid footballer and great delivery. Chanatip is one of the most exciting players. And then the others, you've got Tirasil, who did okay for Hiroshima. He might do better for Shimizu this year. And then Titipan was fairly steady as well for Oita. In terms of the Aussies, I've seen Nathan Burns wasn't used enough, in my opinion, at Tokyo. I think he was a decent player on his day, but didn't get much of a chance. Mitchell Duke was, all right. But again, him and Andrew Nabuta didn't really get much of an opportunity. The only standout really is Langerak, but he's not really had a lot of success at Nagoya. He's just having to save shot after shot, let in by that dreadful defence in front of him. So I'd say the Thai influence has been greater, and I think that should encourage more Thai players to come into the league, and even like Vietnamese players. I think there's so much talent in Vietnam. I'd hope that they would see how well the Thai players have done, and then maybe a team would take a chance on them. But then in terms of the Aussies, you've got Ange Postecoglou's of his success. Hopefully that would indicate to the Japanese teams that there's good football coming out of Australia. Maybe we can tap into their base and get more players in. We've seen Thomas Deng has come in at Urawa, so it'd be good to see if that young Australian player can come in and do well, and maybe that will encourage a little bit more coming into from Australia, because there's definitely talent in both of those countries that can be utilised in Japan.
I think Sam has missed out probably one of the most important Australian in J-League history, Josh Kennedy.
Before
your time, fair enough. Kennedy won the league with Nagoya Grampus, and he had a huge impact on their fortunes. But I would like to see more Australians come over here. But for the time being, I think that in the near term, in the next, say, 2 to 3 years, I think Thai players are going to be ascendant. I think even that there will be more players from Southeast Asia in general. I've heard rumors that a Vietnamese player was on his way over to the J1. I'm not quite sure if that's going to work out, but not just Chanatip, Tirathan, and Tirasin this year, but you've got Kawin up in Sapporo, who's going to be taking on somewhat of an apprentice role, more or less. He's backing up Gu until he leaves to do his mandatory military service. And if you have Thai players playing in goal in the J-League, that means that there would be a Thai player at every position in the J1, or at least goalkeeper, defender, midfielder, striker, which is incredibly impressive. And it does show that if you're talented enough, it doesn't really matter where you're from, you can make it in the J-League. And I think that would inspire a lot of players from the region to have a go at it and to make the effort to come to the J-League. So I think that given the popularity of the league in Thailand, how it's growing there, we're going to see more Thai players coming in the future.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think it's the J-League do deserve a decent amount of credit for the success they've had, particularly in the Thai market. But yeah, hopefully that other Southeast Asian nations will be sending more players over in the next few years. I think some people, myself included, might have raised some eyebrows when the J-League really tried to push into Southeast Asia, thinking of more of a token gesture than a serious policy change. But yeah, it's most definitely borne fruit in the last 3 or 4 years, especially with Chanatip and Tirathan, as you guys have mentioned. And hopefully that will definitely be a springboard to more players, not only from Thailand but, as you say, all across Southeast Asia coming in to the country. So, Kevin, very much appreciate all of your questions for coming on board as a Patreon supporter, and Julian as well, who I mentioned earlier. Thanks to you both for coming on board this week. All right, well, we do have some very meaty questions saved up for part two, listeners, VAR and this, that, and the other. So you'll definitely want to tune in for part two, I can promise you. But for now, we're going to wrap up part one with a question from another of our Patreon supporters, and that's Johnny Nickel. You can find him on Twitter at JohnnyNickel6. And this is a really fun question to finish part one on. Guys, what is your favourite quirk about Japanese football. For example, Johnny suggests teams having five senior goalkeepers, J2 teams loaning players to those clubs in J1, players playing into their 50s, giving supporters and mascots squad numbers, etc., etc. So, Dan, this is right up your alley, this question, I'm sure. So, yeah, what if you can narrow it down to just one, what's your favourite quirk about Japanese football and the J-League?
I was reminded of this at the Super Cup, but I think it's the fact that there is an entire J-League fan subculture dedicated to photoshopping J-League uniforms onto anime girls. I think that, and printing them onto flags and banners.
Rightio.
What else can you say? Like, that's just peak J League in the weird cultural way that makes me love the league so much.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, okay, that's brilliant. Yep, fair enough. That's your answer. So that's your answer, Sam. How about yourself? An interesting question from Johnny.
Yeah, there are so many quirks. It's one of the great things about Japanese football. But I'd go with the desperate need that every club has for a commemorative shirt for any occasion. I remember, I think, when Giravans opened their stadium up by the marina, and the first ball that went over the stadium and into the water, that got a commemorative T-shirt, which is just fantastic. Nowhere else in the world would that be recognised. So, and I imagine people must have bought it, because they keep doing these strange things. I think they're so weird. I think you were talking with John Steele last season about a potential shirt for Jeff United to commemorate 10 years in J2, and I had no idea if that's true or not, but I can believe it just because of how random these little t-shirts are. And I'd like to see if anyone has a collection of these, because I'd definitely like to take a look at it.
I do have the first two Jeff United dog uniforms that they did with Zozo.
Oh, me too.
The goalkeeper ones. Speaking of paying a lot of money for uniforms, I paid a bit more than I'd care to admit to get those. I pre-ordered them properly. The first ball into the Bay shirt was, I think, limited to, I don't know if it was 100 or if it was even less than that. I actually had looked this up for something on Twitter a couple weeks ago, which is why it's fresh in my mind. And that's an amazing quirk. They will do 100 appearances. They'll do commemorating such and such's debut or their first goal or a hat trick. And it's interesting because actually the J-League, or at least some of the clubs, are pairing up with Fanatic.com, which does all of the merchandise for all the big American leagues, MLB, NFL, NBA, NHL. And I was reading something about their design process. In fact, I think my colleague, Japan Times, Jason Koskri, interviewed them about it, and it was interesting that they're moving to be able to have these designs ready and to be able to print stuff on demand and to have it ready faster, which is something that Japanese baseball teams have been doing for several years now. Because, of course, in baseball, you're always getting the 1,000th home run or the 2,000th hit or playing your 3,000th game or something like that. So this is actually something that the J-League has cribbed from the NPB. And, of course, they do it in their own silly ways, but it is important that the clubs be able to capitalize on this sort of merchandising when it comes.
Yeah, most definitely. I think when it came to the Kitakyushu case, the number of shirts was limited to the number of meters that the ball travelled from the point where it left the pitch to it cleared the stand and entered the water on the other side. I can't remember if it was 50 or 60 or something like that. But yes, that's and if you believe that, you're as gullible as John Steele believing the 10-year commemorative Chiba T-shirt, which John was it was definitely prepared to believe, but that was a fictional story. But the J League is it's wonderful league, and it's also got So many wonderful little things that we all love about it. So, yeah, Johnny, thanks for your question. And, all right, guys, well, yeah, we know we still have a lot more recording to come because we're going to turn around and record part two straight away. But listeners, that will not be with you for another day or so. So, yeah, listen out for part two. It's coming soon. But for now, that's it for part one of our J1 Quextravaganza. Thanks to Sam, Dan and Scott. Listen out for part two coming soon. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.